Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington, D.C. insiders and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
All right. Awesome. Hello, everyone. It is so great to have you with us. My name is Brett Buttle. I am so thrilled to be able to lead the economic track for the Aspen Ideas Festival. And with that, we have the amazing privilege of having so many amazing leaders from across the economic spectrum here across the festival. I hope you will join many of our sessions. Today's conversation is obviously a critical one. So many conversations across the festival will be talking about the important technological advancements that AI is making. But today's conversation not only will touch on that component, but we'll also touch about how this incredible technology can work for everyone. So we will hear from amazing people who are working on policy, people who work in the private sector, but really rooted in how this technology can work for community. So with that, it is my pleasure to turn the conversation over to the amazing woman who needs no introduction at all, Ms. Tammy Haddad.
Thank you, Red. Thank you all for coming. Let me ask a question. How many are using AI? How many use Claude? Oh, where's Elizabeth Kelly? She'd be so happy. Gemini, Copilot, ChatGPT. Oh my God, this is a very sophisticated crowd. All right, good. This is the perfect audience. So I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, and I have three experts here to answer the question, is there a road to broadly shared prosperity with AI? So let me introduce them. I'm going to start at the end. Ben McCoon-Cooney brings the view from across the Atlantic and around the world. He cut his teeth at Britain's Treasury during the 2008 financial crisis. And today, he's Chief AI and Innovation Officer at the Tony Blair Institute, advising governments around the world on how to put this technology to work. Please join me in welcoming Ben. Thank you so much. Okay. Lael Brainard has spent her career at the levers of the American economy, and she's pulled nearly all of them, I think it's fair to say. She's been a governor and vice chair of the Federal Reserve, undersecretary of the Treasury, most recently director of the National Economic Council, where she also chaired the White House Competition Council. Today, she's at Georgetown of the Harvard Kennedy School, and she's become one of the clearest voices warning that this AI boom is producing what she calls a two-track economy. Extraordinary at the top, stuck almost everywhere else. If anyone can tell us whether these gains get shared, it's her. Please welcome Lael Brainard. But I want to begin with Chris Womack, right over here, chairman, president, and CEO of the Southern Company, overseeing one of the country's largest energy providers. It's all about energy. You guys know that, right? And AI. Okay, so Chris, tell us how you're handling this new AI economy.
First of all, let me thank Aspen, the festival, for having me here. It's always such a thrill to be here. We're in an incredibly exciting time. And I mean, I know there's a lot of controversy. There's a lot of information going back and forth. But we're in an incredible transformative period that I think will make a lot of what we do in the economy a lot better and a lot more efficient. The other thing I'd say, in this country, in the United States of America, we must win this AI race. We must not cede it to China or to North Korea, because I think it is incredibly critical to our national economy, but also to our national security. And so when I say that, I think about what it means for the power sector and for the energy sector. We've got, I think, around a $32 trillion economy. Energy, power, natural gas, petroleum makes up probably about 3 to 5, sometimes maybe 7% of that economy. But guess what? It's the first 5%. Without the power, these lights aren't on, these microphones aren't working. A lot of things you do simply just doesn't work. With AI, clearly we're in this incredible demand period of growing demand for power. We built some 50 gigawatts of power last year. We're going to build across this country another 80 plus gigawatts of power. And then you move to 27, 28, probably another 100 gigawatts. So we're building a lot of power, yes, to support data centers, but also to support this growing economy, particularly that we see in the South in terms of Georgia and Alabama, Florida, a lot of places where we serve, we see just a lot of growth. And so when you think about it, and Jensen Huang at NVIDIA, he talks a bit about this layer cake of AI. The bottom layer of the cake is power. Then you move up to chips, infrastructure, work your way up to models, and then you get to the top of the cake. It's applications, all the things you guys talk about in terms of your favorite AI resource. But if you want to be fussed at, go to Grok. Grok will say bad things back to you. If you ask a dumb question, Grok will say, God, what a dumb question. So, but the other ones will make you feel good. You know, but it's a wonderful period. And I think there's a lot of, because we're in this early stage of transformation, there's a lot of things we simply don't know. And then there's also a lot of misinformation. I think as we do this right, I think as I incorporate it into our company and as we talk about it, it can really help us do work a lot more efficient. I mean, from predicting weather to predicting when I need to cut trees, or understanding where outages are and what neighborhoods need to have different kinds of service and upgrades. There are just so many things that come from this work. It really helps us do our work better. What I say inside the company all the time, it's not simply about the technology. It's about the solution and the value that AI can bring to us. Yes, there's got to be incredible governance. Yes, I have to spend more investments of making sure that all my cyber activities are secure, because there are a lot of threats that are coming each and every day from a guy sitting in an apartment in Jersey City, New Jersey, or it may be somebody sitting part of a nation state in North Korea. I got to prevent all of those attacks on an ongoing, regular basis. But I think we have to make sure that AI benefits all parts of our economy, all parts of our society, and not just the top. We got to make sure AI is spread very wide and very deep in terms of across our economy. I guess you can tell.
That was very well said, because Lael, coming up next, forgive me for interrupting, but she's going to tell us how it's going to happen. Let's hear it for Lael. Yeah. Okay, how are we going to make this globally competitive and bring everyone else along? Really what Chris is talking about.
Well, look, I think Chris is exactly right. From a national security perspective, from a long-term growth, productivity, prosperity perspective, we do have to win the AI race. It's an incredibly compelling technology, and it's going to really transform the way the economy works. Right now, our economy is incredibly lopsided. 2/3 of the $1 trillion in investment in AI is equal to what we normally would have spent on all business fixed investment in a normal year. So if you look last year, business investment actually outside of AI didn't grow at all. Manufacturing construction was actually down last year. So we have an economy that's incredibly driven right now by that infrastructure build out that Chris is talking about. The stock market, you can see the fluctuations. Apple says something about prices going up because of AI chips demand, and the whole stock market reverberates. So if you look at the returns on our stock market, incredibly, incredibly driven by AI, AI related. And even if you look at consumers, we've got the 20-90 rule. 20%, top 20% of American households have 90% of stock market wealth. So when that stock market wealth is going well, they're doing well, but the other 80% not feeling it. And so our economy right now is a little bit fragile. If something happens on the DeepSeek front again, where it looks like China's pulling ahead, you can see a real stutter in our broader economy. And I think that's something that's really important. Longer term, a few years out, I am very convinced that our productivity growth is going to be higher once AI really diffuses. And this is beyond this initial build-out phase. It's once every business in America reorients the way it does business to take advantage of AI. And at that juncture, we could see 10 to 20 years of productivity growth adding to aggregate growth, something like a third to a half percentage point, which would lead to a dramatic improvement both in our economy, but also in overall incomes. And then we can get to the distribution questions later.
Okay, great. Thank you. Ben, how are you telling governments how to deal with AI? and AI companies. And are you saying they should develop their own? I mean, are we going to have a world where everyone has their own AI?
Yeah.
What's your advice?
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here. And I mean, I think when you did your hands up, I think I saw a few people that put their hands up for Claude, Gemini, and ChatGPT usage. So it could be intrigued what kind of questions come at the end.
I know.
They might
want to
be up on stage,
those
people. Look, it's interesting how the movement has been so fast, right? I think we sometimes forget that, which is the transformative breakthroughs are only 4 or 5 years ago, and we're already at a pace where everyone is putting their hands up. And when we were going around to speak to presidents about the technology revolution, I've been doing this work for nearly 15 years, and previous technological transformations, obviously the internet, cloud policy, we'd go to speak to the presidents and they sort of say, that's the boring, geeky stuff, let's get to the politics. We even spoke to a president once who, when we were talking about the cloud policy, he says, no, I don't need cloud, my country's always sunny. So, we've gone a long way in how people are conceptualizing that. Now, every president or prime minister we speak to today says, what do I do? How do I get moving? And the same way, I think every CEO of every company is under shareholder pressure to actually begin to get adoption across the company. The same is true of countries. Now, I think the sovereignty question and sort of this advice is very, very tricky today, because I think every country and every president will simply say, of course, they would ideally like their own model. They would like their own data centers, but very few countries have $1 trillion to run training runs for frontier models. So really, you are in a case right now where you are mostly probably dependent on the US in some form. You can take the China and the DeepSeek route if you want. There are some open weights and open source models. But I think the question that we then get to with presidents and prime ministers right now, which is like, it's more risky to not work on the adoption than to think, right, we maybe take 5-10 years to try and get to our own sovereign full infrastructure. And I think an analogy that is quite helpful when we speak to this is, if you were to be, let's pick a country, in Mali, let's say, and you were trying to build Mali Airlines, you wouldn't be saying, right, what we need to do is we need to build an aircraft carrier and then all of the other components on it. You would say, right, we'll go to Boeing, we'll go to Airbus, we will buy the technology, we will then put our flag on it, we will train our own pilots, we will build the kind of infrastructure. And I think that's what countries have to think through. Now, the one thing that I think they do need to almost everywhere is, where is your comparative advantage within that stack as well? Because you need some leverage within the conversation. Now, that's not easy. UK is probably third in the world on AI, because we had DeepMind and its kind of infrastructure. I know the Americans now own DeepMind, but we hold on to it a little bit still. But you do need to then think about, where is your application? That could be in biotech, life sciences, that could be some in the chip. And energy is a very big play that is happening around the world right now. Mm-hmm. It's why nuclear is back on the table in most countries, and other forms of technology, geothermal, other bits of building. But that's the bit that really presidents and prime ministers have to think is, like, where do I have leverage and where will I have advantage in this modern era?
Well, Chris, you have leverage because you're nuclear power. You've got these data centers. I wonder how you deal with the issue that we should ask people, how do you guys feel about data centers? How many are for data centers? And how many are nervous about it? Okay, about half and half. But you have been very successful in both.
Yep.
And you don't run data centers, you power data centers. And you've also stepped into nuclear. Can you talk about that? Because this is all in response to AI.
It is. And let me say something first, though, about your question about, are you for or against data centers? There's just this real misperception about what a data center is. Because if you're using, everybody raise their hand about using some AI tool. Where is that coming from? Where is the information being stored? What cloud? Where is it being housed? In a data center. Yeah, there have been some myths about it's driving up electricity prices and it's using all this water and it's making all this noise. Most of those issues have been addressed. I mean, I know for us, as we price data centers, because of what we're charging hyperscalers and data centers to locate data centers, they're paying more. So as a result, bills for everybody else are going down. And because they have closed loop systems for water. So there's a lot of myths there that are just not accurate. Yes, we brought the last two nuclear units online in this country in 23 and 24. And so we're very thrilled to have done that. But with this incredible demand that we see we're looking to take those learnings for others to benefit from them and saying in this country, I think by the middle of next year, we need to make a commitment in this country to build at least 10 more. And so that by the mid-30s, we've got some 10 units online being able to serve the data center growth needs. But yeah, we'll make sure all that is structured in the right way. So customers benefit, communities will benefit, but then also all the customers and the users will continue to have the services they need, and we continue to support our economy, but also our national security. I feel good about where we are there. Yes, complex, the things we have to work through, but I think we're in a good place to make sure we do this the right way.
What about the workplace? How do you talk to you have 30,000 employees, how do you talk to them about AI? I'm sure they're nervous, as many people are.
Not really. I mean, because it's, like I said, you got to get beyond the technology. How does this help you do your job better? What solutions does it provide to the work that you do, whether it's call center work, whether it's the line crews that are going out replacing transformers and fuses, how this gives them more information to restore that service, but also how we use it to help them be safer. So there are just so many values and benefits and speed that comes along with this technology. Yes, we have to govern it properly, but I just think it's a wonderful opportunity in terms of using this technology to provide incredible solutions in terms of how we do our business and run our company.
Now, what about workplace? I mean, we've seen the tech companies lay off a lot of folks. Sometimes they say it's AI, sometimes they don't. But there's no question it's the biggest fear on AI, on data centers. And if you talk about the industry side, they're not investing because they're not sure where the technology is going. Well, how do you look at the workplace situation?
Look, I think this is a massive, important conversation that our political leaders should be taking on today and should be working with labor leaders, with business leaders, with heads of AI companies to really chart a path forward.
How do you do that?
Yeah,
I mean, you got the tech companies, right? They're competing, right? We've got these situations where they're competing directly. So are you suggesting that they come together? Well, this administration is definitely not going to bring them together for workplace issues, or at least not yet. How do you think that works?
Yeah. Well, let's step back and just ask, what are people worried about? And if you look at what they're worried about, the tech leaders themselves have been extremely apocalyptic in terms of how many jobs are likely to be wiped out. Wiped out. Those are the kinds of words that they've used to talk about AI. Now, most the kinds of head of frontier companies know a lot about the speed of their models and how quickly they're reaching milestones. They are not economists, they are not historians. And most people who look at general purpose technologies, which this clearly is, think electricity, think the railroads, information technology, it takes time for the whole economy to reorient, to really optimize around new technologies. So it's going to be a period of transition. And when I think about the China shock, which I think is the right frame to think about, leaders just did not respond. And we saw a million people wiped out in factory towns, very concentrated, with really no transition plans. That's not what should happen this time. I think there's loads of good solutions out there. And ultimately, with the reorientation of businesses, there will be demand for jobs in existing areas, like healthcare, but there'll also be new jobs within businesses that are AI specific. But the fear is real. 2/3 of Americans worried, and the numbers are worse for young people who are the actual AI natives. And that's the other thing I think that's really important to understand here. People are worried because these are the jobs that for the last 30 years they've been told, take these jobs. They're not going to get displaced by migration to China or automation. And now people, and young people in particular, are asking, so what are the good jobs for me and what should I be training for?
All right, I'm going to switch it up a little, Ben, because you're on the cutting edge of AI technology. Can you give us a sense of where we're going? I mean, even the language that people are using now, agentic AI, mm-hmm. harnesses, you know, tokens, all of this language. I mean, when you're not even speaking the same language, how do you move ahead? Again, but you're at the cutting edge. People in, you know, like on top of the mountain last night were whispering what their new LLM is going to do, or their SMR or something like that. Can you give us just like a little look at the future on the AI side of technology?
Yeah, sure. And I think, so you've basically been on an exponential growth function with the capabilities in AI, which a lot of people find very hard to comprehend, but it has been almost, you know, it's been basically true since the beginning that the progress has been compounding at such a rate. Now, agentic AI is sort of where a lot of people think the productivity gains are right now, and obviously just having AI act on your behalf, essentially to execute tasks. The next frontier, which is being discussed, which you know, I think is probably, I'd say, I think privately a couple of the labs might think they are nearly there, is what we call recursive self-improvement. And that means that basically the AI continue to improve upon itself, which, you know, is for any sort of definition that we want to have around AGI, superintelligence, people get very wrapped up in the semantics of this. I mean, that is an extreme capability. Let's just put it as simply as that. Like, you know, you have an AI that continually learns. And, you know, I think there'll be a big question in the same way that you've had with Mythos in the last, you know, basically couple of weeks about how do we deploy a model of that capability into the public sphere. And I think because of some of the thresholds that we seem to be meeting with Mythos and Fable, you could debate how that was handled from the administration. I think some of that safety conversation that kind of got just completely hammered down over the last couple of years.
Yeah, we couldn't say safety. Anyone here from Washington, you weren't allowed to say safety for a couple of years.
Yeah, we rebranded. We had a safety institute in the UK, and we rebranded it the Security Institute.
See?
So it was a very political maneuver. But I do think those conversations will come back, and not just because of the capabilities of the model, but actually some of these other issues that we're talking about, because I think there's a lot of uncertainty and fear within the public, which comes back to this sort of question about how you treat AI. And I still think it's being treated in our sort of public domain as obviously a big thing, but not the thing, right? And I think there's a big separation on that. And so if you internalize that you think AI is this transformative technology, we've seen some of the first order consequences of that, but we're beginning to debate now the second order consequences, which is, you know, actually the economic infrastructure around it, tokenomics, how do we build this in an economically viable way? What are the jobs disruptions? But then I think, you know, you think that through, and I sometimes get into almost an existential state, I do, because you can't think about anything else, but it will totally reorganize how organizations operate in the next future. And it will totally reorganize how a state operates as well, because I think the limit of the construct of the state of where we are today is pretty much hit its limits. And that will be the next version of this will be sort of very AI-pilled in many ways, to put it as bluntly as that.
Chris, what do you think governments should do that they're not doing?
I would agree with Leo. I mean, I think there are a lot of collaborations and conversations with all the players to make sure we're all working in a collaborative fashion to work through this to protect the national economy and our national security. In terms of understanding all the parts of the cake, the layer that Jensen talks about, and understanding the power needs and how that supports the growth in this technology, but making sure that there's that great coordination between all the players in a coordinated fashion to do this in a way that's in the best interest of the country. And just not one-off a conversation here or a conversation there, but I think greater collaboration, greater kind of coordination between all the integral parts that will make this work. I think that's one of the biggest things I think they can do.
All right, let's go back to the markets, Lyle, because you scared the hell out of us. People are drinking vodka in the back because you pointed out just how fragile the economy is right now, right? Because of some of the things we're talking about. I don't want to ask you economic advice or 401k advice for the folks here, but as we've just heard, with this all advancing really fast, what do you do? Perfect example, the administration just allowed Anthropic Mythos back in, right? And then they said to OpenAI, whoa, you can't release this new technology. So this isn't just about employees and government and all that. This is also about the private sector, the whole economy. What do you think?
Well, look, I think the economy has actually proven enormously resilient because of that tailwind from AI. So we just went through a war. You can barely see it. I mean, consumers know that we just went through a war because their entire tax cut got eaten up by paying for gas at the pump, but the economy itself just chugged through. So there's a tremendous tailwind right now from all this investment. But we still haven't quite worked out, as Ben noted, tokenomics. Like, how are these AI firms going to monetize and have business models that are really profitable given this enormous level of investment? And are we going to see some of these open source models getting adopted and embedded because they're so much cheaper? And so all of those things, I think, are out there. I think in terms of the economy, it's actually better that we have these moments where everybody kind of reassesses how much debt they want to be extending to the largest AI companies and reassesses, you know, what the right valuation is. These corrections, I think, are incredibly helpful so that the economy doesn't get so far out and we don't see so many financial imbalances that we're vulnerable to some kind of bigger leveraged correction in the stock market.
I interviewed Van Jones, and he said that AI is the greatest opportunity for his community in his entire lifetime. So let me ask you this question. Do you think AI could actually reduce inequality?
So look, I think there are some really important policy tools that need to be brought to play. I don't think AI on its own is going to reduce inequality. No, I think you need institutions and social agreements that condition how AI affects distribution opportunities. That's where we need to be talking right now. But if you look just I'll just give you a simple example. For those of you who are small businesses, you know what the tax advantages are when you make an investment in anything, but certainly in AI, right? You get your bonus depreciation, you get your full interest deductibility, you get investment tax credits. What happens when you hire a worker? You have to pay for their health care, you have to pay payroll taxes. On the margins, you're always going to prefer that capital investment to the investment in an employee. And right now, we need to make particularly entry-level employees a very attractive investment for businesses. So there's simple things we can do on the margins in our tax code that are not big redistributive plays, which are also being discussed, but on the margins are going to make it profitable for companies to actually bring on entry-level workers and train them just like they would invest in R&D.
All right, so I'm going to ask all three the unfair question, which is, how do you change people's feelings about AI? Ben, I'm going to make you go first.
Well, maybe actually a little bit to touch on that inequality point as well, because I think there's an analogy that you touched on with China shock as well and globalization, which is actually, if you looked at, say, somewhere like France, US, you had the Gilets Jaunes, you had, like, you know, the first Trump administration born out of a lot of that. But then you look at a Vietnam or somewhere, and they're like, yeah, we want more of this, because, like, they see that path upwards as well. And so some of this, you know, actually that inequality and that sort of opportunity axis around the world is very, very different. So I do think a lot of countries see that deep opportunity. But in terms of, I think, the sort of the benefits, I mean, you know, we use the term use case a lot. And really it is just getting towards some of those outcomes. Now, the easiest ones to my mind, which I do speak to presidents and prime ministers about a lot, is healthcare. I genuinely believe that we will have a very different, completely construct of healthcare within our lifetime. And I've got a 3-year-old daughter who, you know, my mind boggles about the potential of both her health span and I think probably even into lifespan questions, which are, you know, big social questions. Education as well. Like, again, if you've we did a trial in a country with an AI tutor on mathematics, STEM. They got two years worth of schooling in 2 months. And now that's a huge, like, you know, if you thought about a jump like that in terms of public policy outcomes, you would have killed for that 10 years ago. So I think you'll begin to see some of these very quick transformative abilities, and actually think in terms of opportunity as well. You know, there are fear of job disruption, but we've seen the first one-person, $1 billion company as well. So it will open up opportunity space as well. And I think there are lots of those that people will see in the very near future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about feelings? How are you going to change feelings about AI? I mean, the three of you could go from room to room and talk about AI. But I ask because I do feel like there should be some sort of public campaign. But I think it's because people don't see the benefit to themselves right now.
Is that to me again?
That's to you again.
feelings. Oh, I'm British, so...
That's why I started with you. Yeah. I thought you could start a trend.
So you don't have to.
Yeah.
Okay, you don't have to answer, Leo, feelings.
No, he's got...
Let's ask the economist. Oh, no, let's ask the CEO. Come on, guys,
feelings.
Don't you want to know an answer? Who wants to know an answer that?
Yes.
Come on.
Yes.
So economists don't do feelings either. But I will say that I think the most important thing is to give people a sense of control. I mean, what now AI is happening to them? They need to feel like there are actual things that they can learn that make them more productive, that make them more attractive as employees. So we need to be providing pathways. The best way to do that is within companies. That's why I said earlier, let's give tax credits so it's really good for companies to actually provide those on-the-job learning opportunities with AI tools. That is the best possible way to do it. But there's loads of ways to work with community colleges and with our middle school to high school, I mean, throughout our curricula so that people understand the appropriate uses and where AI is going to enhance without losing their critical thinking. But the other thing is we do actually need to have some discussion, ideally at the federal level, about what are some good guardrails. What about security or safety, whatever you want to call it, but a sort of sense that, yes, our society can use democracy to actually put guardrails around some of the harms.
Chris, what do you think about guardrails? Will they make a difference? Is a guardrail?
Well, let me say one thing about emotions.
Okay.
I'm labeled as, what, sunshine and roses?
Yeah. Rainbows. Is it rainbows
yeah.
or roses?
Yeah, my wife says that's what I...
Aww.
Every day.
Oh, that's hammered for that. Come on. Wouldn't you want your spouse to say that about you?
Yeah. No, I trade in hope and optimism, okay? That's what I live every day. And so I think there is a lot of misinformation that whatever AI tool you use, you're getting bombarded with stuff. You got to figure out what's right and what's just not correct. Back on the whole Van Jones concept about inequality. I grew up in South Alabama, down in rural South Alabama. And we had textile mills there when I was growing up. I was telling some guys about this morning. And they closed because all the businesses went to China. Guess what? Those jobs have not been replaced. We got the opportunity right now in one rural county in South Alabama to build a data center in a county, guess what? That currently does not have public sewer. Okay? The opportunity I see with the tax investments, with the revenue coming from that data center, can change the life and the economic vitality of that community and all those homeowners. Yes, we got to have guardrails. We got to think about all these other issues, but I think there are just so many other benefits and opportunities that are there to spread this information, to make this information available to everybody. So they can then help guide and direct their lives and do the things they want to do. Yes, we got to protect what it does in terms of job displacement. And we can do that. I mean, we can say, I mean, I see in my company, yeah, I'm going to create some other jobs I didn't have. I'm still hiring engineers to do the design work in my company, but they're also now doing coding. They're doing things that I wasn't doing before. Yeah, there are some threats. But I think there are some incredible opportunities that comes along with this technology. Remember, we're still in the early stages of this. We're four or five years in. There's still much more runway to go. So there's a lot for us to learn. But I just believe this will provide a wonderful opportunity for us in our economy, to protect the security of our country, and really help a lot of communities. So, I mean, that's kind of where I am and how I think about it.
Okay. Now, are there any lessons from previous, you know, the Gilded Age and all these technological revolutions that you think, or evolutions, I should say, do you think apply to this?
So, look, I think this is fundamentally transformational. It is going to change what degrees are worth, what people do in their jobs every day. It's going to be on that transition path, extremely unsettling to a lot of people. And yes, if we had a functioning political system with less polarization, less misinformation, you would see people reaching out across the aisle and coming up with some smart solutions, again, that give people tools to navigate and to thrive, that give businesses incentives to invest, keep people on, retrain them, and also give the ability to workers and citizens to feel like, you know, yes, there are appropriate constraints on privacy, on things that, you know, could harm my kids. All of those things are very feasible. And, you know, what we learn from the Gilded Age, what we learn from the China shock is responding after the fact is wasteful and extremely politically disruptive, leads to this kind of polarization that we're seeing in the political system. So get out ahead, give people tools to feel like they can control and navigate, and make sure that businesses have those incentives, and then we won't be looking at much more radical solutions down the road.
Okay, Ben, we are coming up on a midterm election here in the U.S. of A. There have been a lot of global elections since AI has become so prominent and dominant. Any lessons learned so far? Don't believe what you see?
Yeah, I don't think AI has been a sort of a vote winner or a vote loser so far in any election I've seen. It's definitely something that, you know, if you take actually the last British election, there was some discussion around this, which the current administration, Keir Starmer, who's just obviously stepped down, they took quite seriously, but they still did treat tech policy as the side issue, not driven from the Prime Minister or the President. You've seen other countries around the world where it's become a very pressing issue. Like if you look at a country like Ukraine right now, just because of the crises there, that's actually become absolutely essential, between manpower shortages, et cetera. But translation into elections and politics yet, not so much. But it definitely will, because actually if you take that historical lens, by the way, you know, if you look at the Industrial Revolution, like, you know, you have many lessons from that. Even in the UK, which was the home of the Industrial Revolution, the Labour Party was formed out of the social consequences of that. You know, you had the Factory Acts, you had the Employment Acts. The Labour Party becomes then the party of the workers as in response to the industrialisation of the economy. In the 30s with the electrification, to that point, you had huge social movements against it. You had a group in the UK called the Pylon Poets, led by John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, because they just thought these pylons were just these horrible blight on the countryside. And you look at data centres, the argument's basically the same. And actually in the UK, we've just announced that we want to do a national architecture competition to design beautiful infrastructure. So it seems as a community thing as well, and these are factories or cathedrals of the future. Treat them in a different way than these blights. So I think almost every component of technological change, politics has almost been a lagging indicator, but it did catch up at some point. But I think that's the fundamental lesson now, is that don't lag, shape the discourse and see it, because it's totally obvious that this is the most transformative thing that you need to focus on, and will you know, be both if you get it right, if you get those hope and optimism bits, that will be the vote winner, actually, because it's how you transform your government and the public services that people want, and your economy as well.
That's great. Okay, one more question, and then we're going to turn to the audience. And we have two wonderful people. Please wait till the microphone comes to you. We have a gentleman right there if you want to start over there. Okay, when you come to a Washington AI Network event, I hope you all come if you're in Washington, D.C., we ask everyone this question. And the question is, what is your best prompt? Chris, what is your best prompt? I should tell you while you're thinking about it that I asked Sam Altman this very question. And you know what he said? Ask ChatGPT. So I thought, that's why you're Sam Altman. Okay, what's your best prompt?
It's pretty close. Ask. I mean, ask whatever model I'm using at the time.
Okay. All right, Lael, what do you use?
What do I use or what do I ask?
What do you ask? What is your best prompt or your favorite prompt?
So I've found that I have to always say, critically do anything. Be critical. Criticize your answer, because otherwise I have to do a whole second round of prompts.
Okay. Ben?
So these...
You guys are tough.
So actually, I was in the AI summit in India earlier this year, and Shriram Krishnan, the White House policy advisor, asked me this question on stage and put me right on the spot. And I was thinking, my last prompt was something looking at the Indian bureaucratic system. I can't offend my host. and so I got a bit stuck, and Shriram said I was good at looking at Indian traffic, and it caused a whole rupture on social media. So these are the innocent questions that often get you in trouble. But
right.
I'm going to sort of say that I actually don't use prompting in the traditional form anymore, because I use it as like a reasoning tool. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a Socratic method for me these days. And it is just a pure form of interrogation to elucidate my thoughts. So mm-hmm. I'm not a great prompter anymore, I'm a reasoner.
How many were at the AI loneliness event yesterday? Where, you know, my basic comment was, you know, ask it, because they were worried that the AI was so sycophantic with you. And I'm like, well, just tell it not to be. I mean, this is not hard.
All right, sir.
Please, when you stand up, say which AI you use. Just give us your first name and make it a short question so we can get a lot of people in. Go ahead.
Yep, Francis. A couple of quick observations. First of all, this transformation is extraordinarily disruptive. In the next 10 years, by every scholar I've seen, is going to project some 50% of our American jobs will be impacted. And our country is not ready for it, but that's one observation. But let's go to the real question that I really have, which is real competition with China, which defines the rest of our century, this century. The fact of the matter is that our AI platforms are very advanced and advancing, extremely power-consumed, intensive power consumptions, and very expensive. On the other hand, Chinese model, their opting model, where their algorithm consumes significantly less power, more as effective maybe in applications, and is open source. They give you the tools, go ahead, use it, and 95% cheaper than any of our platforms. That's a real competition.
Okay, question, let's take
it's
it.
It's a question. Yeah. How are we going to compete?
Okay, who wants to go first?
No,
Chris.
We're going to learn from China. I mean, we're going to see what they're doing. We're going to get some benefits and find efficiencies from what they're doing. But I think it's going to be important for us to keep advancing, keep moving forward so we can win this race.
Okay, Kinlayo, sorry, I was distracted.
So I think that's already happening. People in America are using AI that is built on Chinese open source models and modified in various ways. That's going to continue happening. I'll tell you one thing that we shouldn't do. We shouldn't put out edicts that nobody abroad can use our LLMs without any differentiation between countries that are our traditional allies and partners and countries that are strategic rivals. That is just triggered a huge conversation in Europe about, look, we learned that we have to be strategically autonomous from Russia on energy. Then we learned that on critical minerals with China. And now we learn that we have to have our own AI, which is terrible for the U.S. because those big frontier models need a lot of market in order to justify those big investments.
Okay, very quickly.
Hi, thank you. My name's Ellen Sabin. I really appreciated that you brought up children and the next generation, and I'm a little bit of a broken record on this, but I think we learned through cybersecurity and STEM that if we don't start early, we're way too late. So my question is for both governments and companies, what is the obligation and what is the best way to start young enough for both employees and kids to bring AI into families early so the next generation of the workforce knows how to do this with safety and critical thinking?
And we didn't even get to talk about education. We couldn't fit it in, but how people will do it. Ben, do you want to take that?
Yeah, look, I think the simplest way that I would be thinking about this is like an AI tutor for every kid. It would be the most transformative form of education if you could design.
Is anyone doing that anywhere?
Not really. An AI tutor for every child, it would be the most democratizing and powerful way to transform your education system. Estonia has actually just entered into a deal with OpenAI to try and do that, and some countries are looking at it. Now, I'm not saying that you just the kids just sit with an AI all day. Like, you actually think about the form of schooling to do that, but you do want them engaging with it in the right kind of way. I think there are guardrails to put on that. But if I look again at something like, I have my three-year-old playing with Khan Academy, and it's just such a more powerful way to learn than the old broadcast Victorian schooling model of someone basically lecturing at you as well. So I think that's the best place to start in the modern era.
And okay, thank you, sir.
Hi, I'm Krishnamuturi. I'm the founder and CEO of Ampere. We created a world model for industrial energy and equipment physics. My question is for Chris. You talked about generation, but you didn't touch upon the grid constraints of...
Because how much time could there be? The grid, it's all about the grid. Oh my God, everything's on the grid now, right?
If you can't supply power, and also the application side of things. Now, we're talking about LLMs, Gen AI, et cetera. Once we go beyond that, the applied AI side, where the rubber hits the road for manufacturers, small businesses, to be able to use it. Yeah. How are you seeing it? What are the patterns, especially for Ben?
Just let me say, on the power side, you're seeing 1,000 miles or so of transmission build-outs. You're seeing a more distributive infrastructure being built out as well. So as we build the generation, you're seeing all the other components that make this grid so stable and so reliable. Those investments are being made there as well. So it's not just generation, but it's all parts of our system that we're investing in to make sure we can respond to this incredible growing demand.
Okay, Ben?
Well, one thing, I mean, my most hopeful and optimist, I actually think that AI will be a very, very transformative force for climate change, actually, despite some of the other narrative. If you've got $850 billion committed in infrastructure, of which a lot of that is going into clean energy, so you are going to see, you know, basically every country is getting into a redesign of the grid system, which was basically broken. You're then seeing AI to be able to optimize the grid infrastructure to make it load better. You're getting new base load energy in nuclear and other places, which I think will be, you know, extremely powerful for climate change. And then on the last point, AI will also help you solve some of your new forms of energy. Like, if you look at DeepMind, for example, they did a massive piece of work on fusion energy on the thing called plasma cooling. And, you know, if you solve for nuclear fusion in the next 5 years, 10 years, which is a possibility, then, you know, you're at the races.
But Chris, the other thing is you're working with hyperscalers, but you're also competing with them. They're getting into the energy. You know, everyone's moving territory.
Not really. I mean, people believe that. They don't want to get into the energy business.
They just want the power. What do they want?
The power. I mean, yeah.
They well, just give want, it to them. No,
and that's what we're doing. I mean, there's that myth that they want to build nuclear plants.
Well, what are they building in Virginia?
They're not building nuclear plants. There's an MOU,
right.
But it has never happened.
Data center.
Yeah, it's all these myths. I mean, and so I meet with these folks all the time. Mm-hmm. They say, Chris, you do this, we'll sign up with you for an agreement. But you do this, let me do what I do. I mean, so. That's not reality. That's not what's happening.
Okay, one more question. Please stand.
Nancy Lazar. First, thank you for bringing up gouging out middle America, all those goods producing jobs that were gone. I haven't heard that once talked about here in Aspen, so thank you for bringing that up. Second, you highlight how AI has clearly boosted growth, and now we see that it's boosting inflation. Should the Fed raise rates to cool things down?
Just a light question to end with. Well done.
You.
I love it.
Let's hear it for her. Come on.
First, let me just say, if we just did the big poll, 2/3 of Americans are really stressed by how high the cost of living is and much more worried about prices than they are about their incomes not keeping up. So when Apple comes out and it says $200 overnight increase in an iPad or a laptop, I mean, this is just one more thing that makes Americans feel like, my God, prices are out of control. I can't afford beef anymore. We heard this over and over. In terms of the Fed, I hate being too precise because then it will be quoted. But I do believe that we've now seen three waves of inflation right on top of each other. You might have dismissed tariffs as transitory. Maybe you wanted to dismiss oil as transitory. Now you've got AI memory chips driving up the prices of appliances and electronics. And prices have been well below that 2% target. Going into 6 years, I think it's time for the Fed to really show the American people that they have the capacity to bring inflation down.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Thank you all so much. You were terrific. Thank you, all of you, for participating. I wish you all good luck. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.